This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to the Friday Pitch-In, where we explore a few different topics throughout the hour. Coming up, we'll hear from the Senior Associate Dean for Medical Student Education at IU School of Medicine, Dr. Bradley Allen, about his trip to Washington in support of the Opioid Workforce Act of 2019. Later, we'll hear why Indiana Christmas tree farms are on the decline despite steady demand for real trees. But we'll start, as we always do, with a roundup of the big state headlines of the week with Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how's it going?
Not too bad. So what happened this week? The big news on Monday was that House Speaker Brian Bosma's replacement was named, correct?
Yes. Todd Houston, a Republican representative from Fishers, was officially selected as the Speaker-elect, which isn't a position that is usually there. It's not a real position. Essentially, what he's going to be doing is shadowing Brian Bosma. Now, he was selected by the Republican caucus as unanimously to be this speaker-elect. He previously was serving as the co-chair of the Ways and Means Committee, which deals more with the budget and literally all the financial things that go through the Indiana House of Representatives. So now he's going to spend this session shadowing Brian Bosma, figuring out the politics and the policy behind a lot of topics that he hasn't covered before. And is going to be basically doing an internship with Brian Bosma before he takes on the mantle himself.
And this was really no surprise, was it? When Brian Bosma announced his retirement on Organization Day, the name that pretty much everybody thought was going to be the replacement was Todd Houston.
Yeah. I mean, there were two other folks that were kind of thrown out there among reporters. One flat out said that he didn't want to throw his hat in the ring anyway. And the fact that Houston was selected through a unanimous vote of the Republican caucus kind of says that everybody kind of already knew who he was being groomed to replace.
And but Brian Bosma is going to stick around for the 2020 session, of course.
Yes, he is still Speaker Brian Bosma through the end of the 2020 session. And then it'll be during that session, Houston actually still has to be instated as the Speaker of the House through a full House vote. So Democrats still have to vote him in as well. But with a Republican supermajority, it's not very likely that anything's going to muck up that process.
And that's going to happen, as I understand it, at the very tail end of the 2020 session. So he will officially be the House Speaker for part of this session, a very, very small part of this session, but not until the very end.
Yeah.
And what's the reaction been from, let's start with Republicans.
Yeah, so Republicans called him a home run pick. The governor immediately sent out his congratulations. The other Republican leaders in the House were there at an event or at a press event on Monday when he announced that he was going to be the Speaker-elect along with Brian Bosma. So everyone really instilled a lot of confidence over in the Senate. Senate Republicans also said, hey, this guy's going to be great.
What about Democrats?
Well, so his counterpart in the House Minority Leader Phil Giaquinta, said that he looked forward to a healthy and vigorous debate. And in Houston's remarks to the press, he said, you know, I have a lot of respect and really admire Phil Giaquinta. So it looks like that kind of relationship's also really positive.
A healthy and vigorous debate.
Yes.
Could things get dramatic next session?
Dramatic might be a step too far. But, you know, I think what Phil Giaquinta and a lot of other Democrats are looking forward to is a change of pace when it comes to those kinds of debates and discussions. Brian Bosma always seemed to have a lot of control over the House. And so maybe Democrats are hoping to wiggle in a little bit better with someone that they get along with maybe slightly better.
As I understand it, there is some controversy with Todd Houston's full-time job. When you're elected to the legislature, it's only a partial session for the year. You've got to have another job. What's his full-time job?
His full-time job is one of the senior vice presidents at the College Board, the organization that puts together the SAT. He also, in a previous life before that, served as the former chief of staff to the former state superintendent Tony Bennett, who was not popular among teachers by any stretch of the imagination and was the reason why Glenda Ritz got elected in 2014. Oh, I'm going to be wrong on that date. But yeah, so after we published Brandon's story about Todd Houston, some of our partner stations actually got comments from teachers who said, you know what, this, pointing to Houston's selection as Speaker-elect, this just proves that Republicans weren't listening to us when we were there for Red for Ed Day. So there are a lot of emotions coming out of that. And we'll actually have a story on your local Indiana Public Broadcasting station from Jeannie Lindsay about some of those reactions either next week or the week after.
But it sounds like we were still kind of limited in our choices. There were, you said, what, two or three people, one of which did not want it, one of which I'm not sure about. But as I understand it, he was the only choice. And so the vote more or less had to be unanimous.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the the career and technical education funding. What's going on with that?
Yeah. So it's kind of a funky path. So a governor workforce cabinet, which is the governor's workforce cabinet, they have a task force that essentially advised them that family and consumer science classes, or as they're sometimes referred to, classes that teach life skills, weren't specific enough to career and technical education in order to receive funding. And so the GWC, the governor's workforce cabinet, passed this plan unanimously and sent it off to the State Board of Education. Now, earlier this week, State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick criticized the plan, though it is important to note that she is part of the governor's workforce cabinet that passed that unanimously, which is kind of where we get to earlier this week. So the State Board of Ed suddenly gets this plan and has to make a decision on it.
And so what's the issue here? What did they do?
Yeah, so they decided to postpone a decision on this particular series of funding. They were concerned that it was going to cut money for these classes. And when we're talking about classes that teach life skills, we're talking about everything kind of running the gambit. I think a lot of folks, when they think about life skills, immediately go to like shop or home economics and nothing else. But we're also talking about, you know, personal finance or nutrition. And so a lot of teachers were very concerned that they were about to lose their jobs because the funding for their classes was being cut. But the State Board of Ed also kind of gave the indication that they wanted to finish, they wanted to make this decision before January 1st. That way it would give school districts enough time to kind of determine whether or not they were going to have that funding and what their class offerings were going to be for the next school year.
It sounds to me like a lot of things that we hear about when it comes to legislature, be it here or anywhere, that it's a victim of technicality. That they looked at the numbers and they thought, okay, well, that's not part of this, and so we have the consequences.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, you know, as somebody who isn't covering this very specifically, I can kind of get where the idea was going. That, you know, not all of these, you know, classes that are teaching life skills are necessarily going to be perfectly one-to-one applicable to the money that is being designated to career and technical training. But if you're cutting out all of those classes, you're also cutting out a lot of classes that do affect that as well.
All right, let's move down to Franklin and a class action lawsuit. What are we talking here?
Yeah, so Franklin has, to kind of understand where the class action lawsuit is, you kind of have to understand what's going on in Franklin. So a number of kids have died from rare childhood cancers in Franklin. And a few community groups have reached out and said, hey, you know what, this is messed up. This is, we need better monitoring of it. So the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and the EPA had already been in the area trying to monitor and clean up some of the contamination that was there. Still, they're not super convinced that all of this is being done in a way that is helpful. So this new class action lawsuit basically is suing for their property value because they don't feel comfortable selling their homes if their homes are contaminated. And they also want some sort of compensation for the healthcare costs that they've inflicted because of all of the contamination in the area. And there's still conflicts as to whether or not the contamination that is there is causing these cancers. years, so I don't want to give the impression that that is solidly there, but that's what the class action lawsuit is.
Well, when you look at the numbers of these rare childhood cancers and the concentration there at Franklin, some people could look at those numbers and think, how could this not be a factor here?
Yeah, and our environmental reporter, Rebecca Thiel, and our health reporter, Jill Sheridan, did a really beautiful story about why it's so hard to designate something a cancer cluster and why epidemiology and science aren't in the same place that a lawsuit might hope that they would be. So you should definitely check that out.
And another class action lawsuit, this one dealing with a popular agritourism destination.
Yes, Fair Oaks Farms. A few months ago, of course, we saw those animal abuse videos that came out from the animal rights group. There are a handful of folks across the country, mostly located in the Midwest, that are suing because they spent more money in order to buy things that were more animal friendly and instead of paying for a premium for those products. So they believe that they are entitled to compensation. The deadline for them to officially become a class action lawsuit is today. So they have to appoint a counsel. But if that happens, that's a class action lawsuit against Fair Oaks Farms.
We may hear a confirmation on that later. And let's touch quickly on something that we talked about earlier this week. What is Indiana 2022 Way?
Yeah, so it's this really cool engagement project that the IPB News reporters and I and our team, Robin and Scott, are working on to kind of engage folks in our election coverage. A two-way is a more intimate conversation between one reporter and one person to better understand a single perspective. And so to do that, we're hoping people will join our text group. To do so, it's just text election. Elections to 73224, or find us on Facebook at Indiana 2020 Two-Way.
So essentially, we want to conduct a two-way with you, the audience.
Yeah. I mean, we can't cover the elections without knowing what people care about. And we can guess what people care about, but our experiences are limited. I grew up on the west side of Indy. I know a little bit about what that kind of wishy-washy suburban urban, you know, person might think, but we want to hear from you. You guys have better ideas than we do. So text us at elections to 73224.
She keeps the news pages lively for our member station websites, and she keeps the web cave cozy here. Have you decorated it for the holidays yet, by the way?
Not yet. I'm bringing in my stuff this weekend.
Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman, always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Matt.
Up next, we'll hear about efforts to keep up the number of healthcare professionals who are trained specifically to treat opioid use disorder. We'll welcome the Senior Associate Dean for Medical Student Education at IU School of Medicine, Dr. Bradley Allen. He's back from Washington, pushing for the Opioid Workforce Act of 2019. We'll find out what that legislation is designed to do and what the current state of the opioid crisis looks like. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to the Friday pitch-in, I want to tell you about our last show. We heard from Will Evans, who wrote the piece about workplace safety culture at Amazon for Reveal. The article prompted Governor Holcomb to issue a cease and desist letter to the publication challenging some of its facts. Reveal stands by the story, and we unpack the reporting on yesterday's show. You can find that show and all of our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In. And now, the opioid epidemic has impacted communities all over the U.S., and Indiana has not been immune from the challenges that it presents. Expertise from a wide range of disciplines is necessary to effectively address the epidemic. To ensure everyone in need of substance abuse treatments has access to it, there has to be enough trained professionals in the medical industry to turn to. The Opioid Workforce Act of 2019 presents a strategy that might aid in exactly that. Joining us now to talk about the proposed Opioid Workforce Act of 2019 is Senior Associate Dean for Medical Student Education at IU School of Medicine, Dr. Bradley Allen. Dr. Allen, thanks for joining us.
Great. Nice to be here, Matt.
You were just in D.C. yesterday encouraging lawmakers to support the Opioid Workforce Act of 2019. Can you first introduce us to this act? What's it designed to accomplish?
Yes. So yesterday, the Association of American Medical Colleges put together an opportunity to get in front of congressional staffers and three congresspeople to talk more about the Opioid Workforce Act. And what that dealt deals with is a bill that actually was co-sponsored by Representative Susan Brooks from Indiana, along with others. It went through the House and went through the House Ways and Means and was passed on from that point. Now there's a Senate version of the bill that's being considered. And what the bill would do would be to sponsor funding for 1,000 new training spots over the next 5 years, 500 of which would be expansion of existing fellowship programs for training in addiction medicine, addiction psychiatry, or pain management. 500 would be for formation of brand new programs.
Yeah. How much additional knowledge do healthcare professionals need to have in order to deal with this? This is it's not a new problem. We've been dealing with this for a few years, but takes a little bit more.
Yes, indeed. So as you mentioned, this is a widespread program, and healthcare providers everywhere in all disciplines face these challenges and are presented with patients who they detect have issues that are affecting their livelihood, their ability to do the things they need to do to take care of their other health issues. So these fellowship programs will provide the extra nuanced training that allows these individuals then to help address difficult cases of people who are dealing with addictions, but also to help get out amongst the state, hopefully, in all states that are covered by this program, to be able to educate frontline primary care providers to help them feel more comfortable with the right steps, to recognize how to screen for these disorders, how to recognize resources in their community that can be used to help those people navigate their treatment programs, as well as to suggest new technologies, new treatment plans that would come forward over time.
How did you encourage lawmakers to give their support? What does that process look like?
In many ways, it's a relatively easy sell because the opioid crisis has gotten so much attention. We realized that, last year that still 60,000 people lost their lives from overdose, the majority of which were from opioids. And so everybody realizes it's an important problem. It's just how do we address it? So it's easy to get their attention. And now the trick is to convince them that this is a perfect investment for the future, because we may be fighting the opioid crisis now, but there's also, we know, still ongoing issues with methamphetamine, other types of products which we may not even be aware of yet that would still benefit from highly trained individuals who can help us figure out the best ways to treat each individual patient.
What other individuals or groups have showed some support for the bill?
Yes. So the American College of Physicians, it represents internal medicine, really all the primary care associations are behind this bill. So family medicine, OBGYN, pediatrics, emergency medicine, surgery, all comers, run into these situations.
Are there any politics getting in the way of this, or does it have bipartisan support?
This is one of the rare recent examples where we do have bipartisan support. So we're very thankful for that and very hopeful that this will go through, hopefully yet this year, and if not, with the next Congress.
As you said earlier, Indiana Representative Susan Brooks is one of the co-sponsors of this bill. The opioid epidemic has really affected a lot of states and communities. But what do we know about how it has impacted Indiana specifically?
Yes. So yesterday I met also with Representative Todd Hollingsworth, whose jurisdiction goes all the way from Bloomington all the way down to Scott County in Austin, Indiana, where, as we know, at the end of 2014 and into 2015, there was the outbreak of new HIV diagnoses, which were tied to IV use of opioid medications. And so that was a stark reminder of just what impacts this can have beyond the actual use of the opioids, but what other complications can come with this type of activity. So that has gotten the attention of all care providers in Indiana, because we know this could happen in other areas, both rural and urban. And this, too, resonates with people from every state across the country, knowing that there are hot spots, that the CDC has identified at least 220 different communities where this same type of an outbreak could come about.
So along those lines, where does our state fall short in its ability to comprehensively address this epidemic?
Because of even before 2014 and the Scott County HIV outbreak, the state was already working towards this by asking providers to think twice before they prescribed opioids and to carefully monitor how much they gave to each patient. They have then subsequently responded to calls from around the state about what kind of information providers needed to get up to speed and be able to watch their population of patients more closely. So IU School of Medicine has been helpful in their continuing medical education branch to listen to those and provide seminars, both online and in person, to address those questions that providers have. And then we're also doing a lot with our medical students and our residency programs to gain a better and deeper understanding of pain management that doesn't require opioids, and then, again, how to do appropriate screening and referral for those people that may already have some substance use issue, whether it be opioids, alcohol, what have you.
And not only is training for the doctors we do have important, but so is the issue of having enough doctors. The Association of American Medical Colleges projects that by 2032, demand for physicians in both primary and specialty care will outpace supply by almost 122,000 physicians. Do we already see the beginnings of this trend?
Yes, certainly Indiana is one of the states that's projected to have the largest gap in primary care providers by the year 2020. So IU has expanded the number of medical school students in their program. We now have Marion University producing new physicians coming out as well. We have been able to work with the state to develop programs to look for expansion of residency training programs in primary care related areas, and that's happening in places like Evansville and Fort Wayne, projected discussions in places like Gary as well. So we're trying to produce more providers, and specifically this bill then would help us get that extra level of training in addiction psychiatry, addiction medicine, and chronic pain management.
Yeah, it seems like with the factor of the opioid crisis, not only do we have less people going into the medical field, but there are more people who need care. Are both of those factors at work with this gap here?
Yes. So, again, we have plenty of people in need and unique needs that, again, from an addiction therapy standpoint, from a comfort level and an adequate number of prescribers for medication-assisted therapy for people who have opioid and other addictions is very important to close that gap as quickly as possible.
When it comes to treating substance abuse and chronic pain, can you talk about some of the challenges around those areas of medicine and care?
Yes, I think the approach really needs to be to look at the whole patient and to be able to sit down and listen to what their needs are, what has put them in a position where they maybe have been compelled to develop an addiction. Do they have unaddressed chronic pain that could be addressed by other types of modalities? Are there undiagnosed or undertreated mental health conditions that have put them in a position to be more vulnerable to develop addictions? And then also to realize that, you know, addiction is an illness, and it's not a choice. We need to make sure that we don't treat people in a manner that, indicates that they've done something wrong. We need to be able to understand and help them find ways to live with their issues that brought them to that point.
Do you think that that's among the biggest societal challenges that we're facing with the opioid addiction crisis?
I think so. I think it's been poorly understood, and that extra education that we can gain from having more providers who are trained in these areas to get out in communities and train all healthcare providers to be aware of how to address those needs more effectively.
But how have we done, say, what kind of change have you seen, I don't know, in the last 10 years as to how the public views it versus how we used to?
I think we're starting to see a little bit of improvement in terms of removing some of the stigma associated with it as we realize just how prevalent it is. But, different addiction waves and epidemics have been known to mankind, you know, throughout the years. So whether it be opioid addictions after the Civil War, after some of the world wars in the 60s or whatever, the drug may change, but the problem still remains. And part of it feeds into, you know, our under availability of resources to help people cope with mental health illnesses, anxiety and depression, which may be big factors behind some people who develop addictions.
How have we historically treated chronic pain?
Well, poorly, I think, is the bottom line. And in the 80s and 90s, particularly the 90s, we were influenced by industries that compelled us to not be afraid of using opioids, to use these new long-acting agents they had that were very effective in relieving pain and with very little risk of addiction. That's proven to be not true. And so some of the pharmaceutical companies now are in litigation because of that, what's viewed as false advertising. But that's created now a cadre of people who have gone from prescription opioids to using those things that are more readily available now, heroin and the synthetic forms of heroin, which were extremely dangerous and a very high risk of unintended overdose and death.
What are better ways to treat chronic pain? Are there alternative strategies that have proven to be effective?
Yes. Recent studies have shown that non-opioid medications are as effective and probably more effective than opiates for people who are living with chronic pain. And that's a message that we need to get out to all providers. In addition, there are non-medication methods of handling pain because typically these chronic pain states may not be reversible. These may be something that people have to live with for the rest of their life. So teaching them methods that they can minimize the pain using things like physical therapy, occasionally surgical interventions, injections, acupuncture. There's a lot of different things that we can use that don't involve addictive substances that probably are at least as good, if not better, than what we've relied on in the past.
What are typical cases when we're talking about chronic pain? Where are people hurting and why?
Chronic back pain obviously is a big issue. Other joint pains, hips, knees, shoulders, things like that, that are real problems. And it affects the way that people can live their life and do their jobs and support their families. So we need to recognize that there are issues there. We need to help them find solutions that can help improve their functionality and improve their quality of life. And, that's one of the keys to increasing chronic pain management options for patients.
The IU School of Medicine has already made changes to the way that students are educated to best treat addiction. One of those changes involved an earlier focus on drug abuse screening. Why is this an important element to emphasize?
I think because it's so prevalent and such a big issue that we need to address with each and every patient, we need to make sure that just as they learn how to speak to a patient and gather their history about things that are going on with their general health, to also remember to automatically ask some screening questions. They're very simple. They don't take very much time, but can give insight to a provider as to whether there may be some underlying things that need to be addressed with further questioning to see if their use of substances is impairing their life in any way.
So in short, the use of these opioid painkillers are in no way a quick fix and do not work for every single patient, of course.
Correct. They may seem like a quick fix, but the long-term effects are not good. And when we're screening for these or teaching how to do these substance screening methods, which we also do with our residents, we're not just looking for opioid use. We're also looking to see, are they using excessive amounts of alcohol or other substances which are deleterious to their overall health?
Looking ahead, what are the next steps for the Opioid Workforce Act?
Well, we hope that it will be taken up for votes yet perhaps this session, because it is enjoying support from both sides of the aisle. And then if that goes forward, then I suspect that there will be requests for applications of interested programs who want to either expand or develop new programs in these three areas of addiction medicine, addiction psychiatry, and chronic pain management.
Is this a first step, or once this passes, do you think that momentum will be gained to have more things come down the line, and what would those look like?
I think it's an important first step. So we have seen that the number of graduating medical students who want to go into psychiatry is going up, and that's a positive for our mental health needs across the U.S. But to take that next step to train in areas of addiction from psychiatry or internal medicine or pediatrics, we need to have those fellowship spots available for that extra training. So I think it's a good first step forward, but there's going to be ongoing needs.
Do you think that we will see this act pass?
I am quietly confident that it's going to move through, again, either this term or next, because the majority of the people that I've spoken with, legislators in both the Senate and the House, seem to be very supportive of this.
And you were in Washington recently. Who was at your side? Who else is there supporting?
So the Association of American Medical Colleges has been a big proponent of this and helped put together that conference. So the leadership of that society was there, along with Senator Brooke. Representative Brooks showed up to introduce me, actually, which was nice. And we also had Representative Schneider, who represents the north side of Chicago, and then another physician representative from Tennessee who talked about his experiences in OBGYN practicing in rural Tennessee and how even back in the old days he would see this problem.
Dr. Bradley Allen is Senior Associate Dean for Medical Student Education at IU School of Medicine. Dr. Allen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Matt.
Coming up, research done at IU shows that Indiana Christmas tree farms are on the decline. That doesn't mean that demand has gone down, though. There are still plenty of consumers who want a real tree for the holiday season. We'll talk to the president of the Indiana State Christmas Tree Growers Association next in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. So, is your tree up yet? Is it a real one? Or do you still have to make that trek into the attic or storage room to get out the artificial one? Turns out, consumer demand these days is high for real Christmas trees. But despite that, Indiana Christmas tree farms are on the decline, and there are a lot of reasons for that. Joining me now is the president of the Indiana Christmas Tree Growers Association, Jeff Koning. Good afternoon, Jeff.
Hi, Matt.
First of all, aside from the obvious answer, what is the Indiana Christmas Tree Growers Association? What do you do besides grow Christmas trees?
It's a partnership of farmers from all over the state that work together to market their Christmas trees, to share ideas and collaborate on different techniques and different ideas that have worked and often what doesn't work for them so that we can come together and promote the industry.
So when you do get together and talk about those sorts of things, how does that conversation change from year to year? Do you share like you said, you share growing techniques. You share things like this species is doing well, this one not so well, this is what's going well on my farm, et cetera?
Yes, that's exactly correct. It's an excellent group of people. There's always lots of back and forth. There's never any competitive pressures or anything like that. Everybody wants to work together to help everybody else out.
And are you yourself a grower?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. What do you grow? How many trees do you have?
The farm on which I work is approximately 5 acres, located near the Turkey Run State Park area. There's approximately 2,500 to 3,000 trees in the ground currently.
25 to 3 on 5 acres? Really? You can grow that many on 5 acres?
Yes, approximately a half acre to an acre each year is what is planted for future harvest. So not all of those trees will be harvested at one time. It's a progression.
So how have you seen the industry change in, say, the last 15 years?
Well, I am the farm on which I work is relatively new. The first harvest was just last year. But I can see the species change from past years. Often it was Scotch pine and white pine were the predominant species grown and sold in this area. But that has changed to more exotic varieties of trees that do not natively grow here in Indiana, such as Kinane firs, blue spruce, and varieties like that.
And so can you describe, first let's go to the traditional varieties that have grown well here and are native, Scotch pine and white pine. Can you describe those for people who might not know the difference?
Yeah, a eastern white pine is a personal favorite variety of trees. It's long needles. It's a very soft tree, so it won't take a heavy ornament, but it is a beautiful, flowing, kind of puffy-looking tree to my eye. It's an excellent option for those that might have an allergy to Christmas trees. A Scotch pine is more of a medium needle-length tree. Has a paler color, but is a very stout branch, so it'll take a nice heavy ornament if necessary. That was the number one tree for years and years and years, and it still is a favorite.
And how does that compare or contrast with these, as you say, more exotic varieties like the Fraser firs and Kinane firs?
Both of those firs are very, very similar species. The Fraser fir likes temperatures that are a little cooler than we often experience in Indiana, so a Kinane fir is an excellent substitute. They're a short needle tree. They have a very robust green color, very dark green color that is very, very popular. They're also very aromatic, so when people say they want the Christmas smell, that's what they're talking about is what's coming out of those type of fir trees.
Yeah, that's always been my favorite thing about having a real tree versus an artificial tree is the fragrance. So if I use an artificial tree, I find myself buying a ton of pine-scented candles and throwing those around the house to kind of compensate for it. So those fir varieties are the ones where you'll get that experience.
Yes, other varieties do have that aroma, but it is most commonly associated with those type of fir trees, yes.
Now, according to an IU study led by Associate Professor James Farmer from the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs, there's been a 40% decrease in Indiana Christmas tree farms since 2002. How are we feeling that? Are farms themselves getting smaller? Are many closing down?
Yes, it's a generational change predominantly. Christmas trees are a long time to market. Trees going in the ground now won't come to market for 7 to 10 years on average. So the drought in 2012, for example, and the recession back in 2008, 2009, those trees, had they gone in the ground and survived, would have been coming to market now. So that does cause pressures, which coupled with the generational change contributes to the decline.
So Christmas tree farms are not necessarily the kinds of farms, or we're seeing perhaps that they're not necessarily the kinds of farms that families pass down, or perhaps the younger generations aren't as interested in doing it.
It is a year-round labor. It's not just the few weeks between Thanksgiving and Christmas. That is the most enjoyable time to be able to see the families out there. And, of course, that's when the revenue is generated. But planting starts in March, April, perhaps early May. And, of course, then there's pest control and mowing and weed eradication and shearing and shaping the trees happens throughout the rest of the year. So, yes, it is some work to bring a tree to market.
Now, despite this so-called decline that we're talking about, I understand demand is staying pretty steady. Is that correct?
That's correct, and I would personally anticipate it will only increase as buyers realize the economic and environmental benefits of having a real tree.
Yeah, and the kind of Christmas trees people put up. I'm talking about real versus artificial. As I understand it, that doesn't really change for most consumers year over year. You're either a real tree person or a fake tree person. How does the industry try to get people to come around to a real tree when those habits are kind of, I don't know, cemented?
We'd like to have everybody recognize that there are economic and environmental advantages to having a real tree. In the past, perhaps there was a perception that cutting down a tree was bad and having an artificial tree that would be there for years and years was advantageous, but that's not necessarily so. You know, they're sustainable, they're renewable resources. You know, three trees are planted for each one that is harvested. They're fully recyclable. They provide wildlife habitat. They provide watershed protection. They're oxygen generating, and they're just aesthetically pleasing. It's wonderful to look at a patch of trees. So with all of those advantages can certainly outweigh having an artificial tree.
And speaking of environmental factors, winters are getting warmer and wetter, which is good for insects and fungus, but not necessarily good for traditional Christmas tree varieties. What has that meant for Christmas tree growers?
You need to be diligent and on keeping on top of your crop. It means being able to constantly develop your skills and your knowledge. It's not just a one-time learning curve. It's an ongoing learning cycle to be able to keep up with the next thing coming on, whether it be a fungus or a bug or something like that.
And there are species that are more robust than others when it comes to dealing with those kinds of factors, whether it be fungus or insects. Does a lot of that have to do with what is naturally found in Indiana versus, as you say, the more exotic varieties?
Yes. A white pine or a Scotch pine is native to this region, for example. So they are able to tolerate the temperature extremes that we often experience here better than perhaps a fir tree, for example, which is non-native.
And how long does it take to grow typical Christmas tree varieties?
Depending on the variety, a Christmas tree can take between 7 to 10 or more years to bring to market. Trees planted this year will not be coming to market until approximately 2027.
So at least 7 years. Does it go any below that?
We would like it to. Occasionally, if you have a good string of good years, you can bring a tree to market in as little as 5 years.
Let's talk about the economic advantages of a real tree. Who does it help when you choose to get a real tree?
It helps a local farmer based within a community, as opposed to a larger chain store, for example.
And also, I would imagine that, you know, if you're ordering or buying an artificial tree, that money goes to the store that you bought it from, which may not necessarily be based in Indiana. And certainly the real tree probably, or the fake tree, is not made in Indiana. And that factors into it as well. So when you buy an artificial or a real tree, all of that money, it sounds like, stays in the state more or less.
Yes, it does. And it doesn't go just to the farmer, but all the staff that the farmer would need to hire to assist him during the season.
So what about the price range? How much should we expect to spend on a real tree?
You'll always remember the memories you had with the tree before you ever remember what you spent on it. But a tree could be anywhere from $50 to $75, perhaps more, depending on the size and the species that you would select.
What are the lower priced species versus, say, the higher priced species? Are we talking about the Indiana grown versus the, maybe not Indiana grown, but Indiana native versus the non-native trees? Is that where the price difference comes in?
Yes, the pine trees, the native varieties, are often faster to market and frequently have less pressures on them, such as insects and fungi and other pathogens. The exotic species, such as the Canadian firs, will be priced more. And, you know, for the truly novel variety, maybe more, but they will be unique, such as a concolor fir, a Norway spruce, a blue spruce, for example.
Yeah, what are the, I guess, what's on the high end of Christmas trees that would be available in Indiana, and why are they at the high end? What's pleasing about these sort of higher end trees?
Well, a concolor fur is notable for a distinctive hue. It has a whitish cast to the bluish green. It also has a very distinct odor. A lot of people attribute it to a citrus smell. A noble fur is just a very wonderful shape and form of a tree, and it has just a very intense dark blue-green color.
So since, as you say, demand is picking up, do you anticipate that there will be new tree growers in the future, or will existing farmers try to do their best to plant more or have more coming up? It seems like a pretty heritage niche to jump into.
Yes, I anticipate that growers will continue to attempt to plant more to meet the need, but I also anticipate that new growers will come on board.
And so with regard to those new growers, if someone is curious about becoming a Christmas tree grower, what do they need?
Contact us at the Indiana Christmas Tree Growers Association. We would be more than happy to provide information through the association, but I have found that my fellow growers are an extremely generous, outgoing group of people that are more than willing to share everything that they have.
So if people are interested in getting a real Christmas tree from an Indiana Christmas tree grower, where can they find one?
They could go to the Indiana Christmas Tree Growers Association website, indianachristmastrees.com, and there is a farm locator.
And that tells us where to go, and what else does it tell us? Does it then connect us to those growers' websites if they have them, and maybe describes other amenities?
They will find an icon showing the county in which the farm is located, and then there will be links to their individual websites. It'll also have their phone number if they would like to call the individual farm for more specific information. Despite the declining farms, trees are available, but it may require some flexibility, such as considering a different species or perhaps a different size of trees than what they originally envisioned. But even if they get a different tree than what they originally wanted, they're still going to have a wonderful, wonderful tree.
And so with that in mind, if someone wants to buy a Christmas tree, a real Christmas tree from an Indiana Christmas tree grower, but wants to be mindful of the species and go easy on the farmer and go easy on the environment, what should they be looking for? The kinds of varieties we've already talked about?
Yeah, they could, you know, if they would like to have a native variety, they could request a white pine, for example. If they would like a current favorite trees, such as the fir trees.
But you said that the fir trees, though, are kind of the more out-of-state varieties, although they can be grown here. It's not as easy.
That is correct, but they are currently the in-vogue tree, and most growers are attempting to provide those variety of trees. They're still going to end up with a wonderful tree.
All right, and finally, how has your business been so far this year? We've kind of we're kind of right in the middle of it right now, and I appreciate your time because this is kind of the busiest time of year for you.
Well, it's always a busy time on a tree farm, but yes, this is when the customers see it is this time of year between Thanksgiving and Christmas. It was kind of rainy and scotchy weather-wise for opening weekend, but you know the forecast is good for this weekend, I believe, throughout the state. So I think that all the tree growers will be very, very busy and create a lot of happy memories.
Jeff Koning is the president of the Indiana Christmas Tree Growers Association. Jeff, thanks for your time and good luck this year.
Thank you. Have an excellent day, Matt.
And I'd encourage you to check out the story out of IU by reporter Mary Keck on Professor James Farmer's research on the Christmas tree industry in Indiana. You can find that at news.iu.edu, and I tweeted it out this afternoon as well. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Pelser. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Our managing editor is Scott Cameron. Technical directors are Adam Gross and Chris Flood. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you find podcasts so you always know what we're talking about. Join us Monday when we'll welcome NPR Morning Edition host and fellow Hoosier Steve Inskeep to talk about the keynote address he's giving at the Richard G. Lugar Symposium for Tomorrow's Leaders at the University of Indianapolis. We'll also find out what Indiana attractions made the cut in the new print edition of Atlas Obscura. Until then, have a great weekend. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.